Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 15, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is the Halbig case and the IRS interpretation of the Affordable Care Act subsidy provisions. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from two experts today on our call, with only brief introductions, so we can get right to the topic. We'll hear first from Professor Jonathan Adler. He is the Johann Varhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. And he'll be followed by Professor Nicholas Bagley, who's the Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School. They're going to each give opening remarks of about 8 to 10 minutes, and then maybe a little back and forth between the two of them. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Adler, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Dean. And it's certainly a pleasure to be on this call today with Nick Bagley to talk about this issue. Halbig is one of four pending cases challenging the IRS rule that purports to authorize tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies for qualifying health insurance plans purchased on both state and federal exchanges. And what I want to do is just give a little bit of background about how this IRS rule fits into the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and where it came from, and then briefly outline the legal claims that are being made in Halbig and that are currently being considered by the D.C. Circuit, at which point I'll turn it over to Nick. So one feature of the ACA is the creation of health insurance exchanges. These were intended to be marketplaces for the purchase of health insurance that would enable consumers to engage in comparison shopping and hopefully hold down the cost of health insurance by, among other things, facilitating competition. The idea was that the exchange marketplaces would be kind of like Expedia or Kayak for health insurance. The other thing the function the exchanges were supposed to provide was to be a mechanism through which the federal government could provide both tax credits to qualifying individuals for the purchase of health insurance, as well as cost-sharing subsidies to insurers so that insurers could offer insurance at lower prices. A key question in Congress while the Affordable Care Act was being developed was whether or not exchanges should be state-based or whether or not it would be preferable to have federally run exchanges. And the House and the Senate differed on this point. The Senate bill, which became the basis for the Affordable Care Act, adopted a state-based approach. This decision was made after hearings looking at the pros and cons of whether to have state-based exchanges or a federal exchange, and was also made in response to the concern of some senators that healthcare reform not be an excuse for a federal takeover of health insurance. The House bill, on the other hand, preferred a more federally based model. Under the law that was eventually enacted, under Section 1311, the Affordable Care Act instructs states to create their own health insurance exchanges. Yet, as we know, the federal government cannot require states to implement federal regulatory programs. That sort of commandeering is prohibited under cases like New York versus United States and Prince. And what the Supreme Court has said in New York is that where Congress tells states to do something, where Congress says that states shall perform a given activity, that there are two ways to interpret that language. We can either interpret that language as an unconstitutional command, or preferably, we should interpret that language as the indication that Congress is providing incentives for state cooperation. And here, the way the Senate bill is written, there are several incentives. One of them is that the statute provided startup funding for states to help states create exchanges. It instructed states that they could be relieved of their maintenance of eligibility requirements for Medicaid once they created exchanges. And then in the newly created Section 36 of the Internal Revenue Code, the statute authorized tax credits in exchanges, quote, established by the state under 1311. And this language is repeated several times in the relevant provisions of 36B. And this essentially provides for tax credits in states that create their own exchanges. And it's just worth noting that this is a mechanism that Congress has used in other legislation. Congress has frequently conditioned tax credits or other tax benefits on state cooperation with federal goals. And as was pointed out at oral argument in Helbig by Judge Randolph, there is another provision of the Internal Revenue Code that has the same author as the Senate Affordable Care Act, Senator Baucus, that conditions benefits on state cooperation with equivalent statutory structure. When the Senate bill was enacted, despite some opposition in the House to using a state-based model, because after the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts, the only way that health care reform could be enacted was for the House to accept the Senate bill and then agree to make a limited number of amendments through the reconciliation process. So we ended up with the Senate bill, even though many healthcare reform supporters preferred a different approach, preferred an approach that was not reliant upon state implementation of key provisions. At the time the bill was enacted, it wasn't clear that these provisions would be much of a problem, because as many healthcare reform supporters, including the president and including recently departed HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, said, they expected every state to willingly and enthusiastically to create their own health insurance exchanges through which eligible consumers could purchase health insurance. Well, it turns out that assumption was wrong. Over 30 states eventually elected not to create their own health insurance exchanges, creating the possibility that qualifying individuals in those states would not be eligible for tax credits or cost-sharing subsidies for the purchase of health insurance. In response to this concern, the IRS in May of 2012 issued a regulation that says that tax credits will be available in both health insurance exchanges created by states under Section 1311, as well as those created by the federal government under Section 1321. The claim in Helbig and in the three other pending cases against this regulation is rather straightforward. The text of the Affordable Care Act authorizes tax credits in exchanges that are, quote, established by the state under 1311. The argument is that an exchange that is neither established by a state nor established under Section 1311 cannot qualify as the basis for tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies. The federal government is not a state. The federal government's authority to create exchanges where states do not is provided under Section 1321 rather than Section 1311. Moreover, Congress expressly defined state for purposes of the law as one of the 50 states or the District of Columbia, and did not enact any language creating equivalence between the federal government and the states. Long before this suit was filed, around the time the IRS was proposing and finalizing this rule, Michael Cannon and I engaged in a fairly exhaustive survey of the history of these provisions and the legislative history of the Act, and we were unable to uncover any legislative history or textual provisions in the Act that contradict the plain language of these relevant provisions. And indeed, to this day, I don't think anyone has come up with such indications of contrary intent either. I think most notably, there is not a single contemporaneous statement by any member of Congress saying that under the Senate bill, tax credits would be available through federal exchanges. No one ever made that statement. There are plenty of statements saying every state will create an exchange, and there are equivalent statements saying that tax credits will be available in every state, but the latter claim clearly follows from the former. If you assume every state would create its own exchange, then certainly tax credits would be available in all the states. Our analysis of this is that not only is the text clear, but that this is simply one example of a fairly common practice by Congress of conditioning tax credits or other favorable tax treatment on state cooperation with federal goals. Congress believed that states would accept this offer, much as Congress expected states to accept the offer of the Medicaid expansion. What changed or what was in error was not the drafting of the statute. That is, there is no Scrivener's error or or drafting mistake. Rather, the mistake was in assuming that states would respond to the incentives that Congress had created the way states had responded in the past. And that sort of error or that sort of misjudgment is not the sort of thing that allows an agency like the IRS to enact a regulation that is contrary to the plain text of the statute. And the final point, which is just worth underlining, is that the tax credits here aren't simply the IRS failing to collect additional taxes from individuals. They are refundable tax credits, and the combination of the tax credits and the cost-sharing subsidies are such that the vast majority of the money the vast majority of the tax credits and the subsidies will actually manifest themselves not as reductions in federal revenue, but actually as outlays from the federal treasury. So the authority the IRS is asserting here is not merely the authority to alter the plain text of the statute, but also the authority to essentially make draws on the federal treasury that are not authorized by Congress. And the argument in Holbig and the other cases is that's the sort of authority that the IRS does not have because it is contrary to law. The District Court in the District of Columbia, as well as the District Court in Virginia, disagreed with these arguments. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit heard oral argument on March 25th, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit will hear oral argument on a parallel case called King versus Sebelius next month, and there are two other cases pending in Oklahoma and Indiana. Both of those remain in district court. I think I've hit my allotted time, so I will turn it over to Nick.
Hi, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me and to Jonathan for participating in this conference call. So Jonathan's presentation of the case gets pretty much everything right apart from the sort of bottom line takeaway. The relevant language here, quote, established by the state under 1311, undeniably suggests, at least at first glance, that tax credits shouldn't be available on federally established exchanges. But in figuring out whether to attribute to the phrase the significance that Jonathan and others would assign to it, you've got to look at the broader context of the statute. And it's not at all unusual for a statute to say one thing, but not mean that thing upon closer examination. And for support here, you'd want to think about the Supreme Court's decision in Brown and Williamson against FDA. This is back in 2000. The FDA had asserted that it had authority to regulate tobacco as a drug, and stripped of context, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act appeared to allow the agency to so regulate tobacco. The agency had jurisdiction over drugs. Federal law defined drug to include substances that are intended to affect the structure or any function of the body. Nicotine fit easily within the statutory text. But the Supreme Court said no. It said the statute clearly precludes FDA from regulating tobacco as a drug, nicotine as a drug. And the Supreme Court insisted, as it always insists and has always insisted, that the words of the statute have to be read in context. After all, words aren't self-interpreting. They communicate meaning only because the speakers, Congress, and the listeners, the public, form part of a common linguistic, cultural, and political community. And the court said that Congress couldn't possibly have meant, in giving FDA jurisdiction over drugs, to communicate the message that the agency could regulate and even ban tobacco products. And the court's point wasn't that legislative history or some broad appeal to statutory purpose could defeat the plain language of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Instead, the court examined the statute as a whole, along with the whole history of tobacco regulation over the course of the 20th century, to try to figure out how an ordinary person reading the statute would understand the text. And the court quite understandably concluded that Congress didn't mean, by enacting the open-ended language of the FDCA, to arm FDA to regulate tobacco as a drug. So in arguing how big, the government is taking a page from Brown and Williamson. They say, look, the statute does say established by the state under Section 1311, but that can't plausibly communicate the idea that tax credits are unavailable on federal exchanges. And why does the government advance this argument? Well, to begin with, Section 1321 of the Act, this is the provision that allows the federal government to establish exchanges. Section 1321 instructs the Secretary of HHS to establish, quote, such exchange when a state fails to create a 1311 exchange. In context, Section 1321's reference to, quote, such exchange quite obviously refers to the exchange that states are required to establish under 1311. which is to say the Secretary of HHS, when she sets up an exchange on a state's behalf, is really stepping into the shoes of the state and establishing its exchange. She acts pursuant to authority under 1321, but she's setting up a 1311 exchange. And when somebody purchases insurance on a federally facilitated exchange, they are purchasing insurance on a 1311 exchange. And there are other statutory clues that reinforce this point. You want to take the statutory provision that explicitly requires every single exchange, including those explicitly established under 1321, to give information to the Department of Treasury about, quote, the aggregate amount, end quote, of advanced tax credits that each individual receives when purchasing a plan on the exchange. What possible purpose would a reporting provision like this serve if not to give Treasury notice of tax credits that were going out on a federal exchange? It would be a senseless instruction, another clue that the statute doesn't have the exclusionary meaning that Jonathan would ascribe to it. Better still, the ACA only allows, quote, qualified individuals to buy health plans on the exchanges. A qualified individual is defined in the Act as someone, quote, who resides in the state that established the exchange. So under Jonathan's interpretation of the statute, it would mean that no person, no one, could purchase an exchange, purchase a plan in those states that had declined to establish their own exchanges. So that means nobody in Michigan, for example, could go on the exchange that the federal government established for the benefit of Michiganders. And that would be a crazy interpretation of the statute. But again, that's what the reading that Jonathan is advancing here would suggest. The much more natural inference, if you read the statute as a whole, is that in a refusal state, the federal government would act on the state's behalf in setting up the state's exchange. Furthermore, you'd expect that if Congress were going to take a step that might lead more than half the country to lose out on tax credits, that would give the states a lot of leverage to thwart the basic purposes of the Act, surely it would have made that intent much plainer on the face of the statute. And the phrase established by the state under 1311 is not in a prominent portion of the statute. It's awkwardly crammed in subsection B2A in a section of subpart C of part 4 of subchapter A of chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code. And it's part of the equation for figuring out how much the tax credits are going to be. Why assume that Congress meant to communicate its intent about the availability of tax credits in such a roundabout and non-obvious way? And the greater context in which the ACA was adopted just reinforces the point. The ACA wasn't exactly adopted in a vacuum. It didn't pass unnoticed. It was hotly debated. Its provisions were subject to intense scrutiny. Yet no one during the debate, no one, ever said that the statute that Congress enacted was meant to strip individuals and federal exchanges of subsidies. And to the contrary, the Congressional Budget Office scored the act on the widely held assumption that tax credits would be available in both exchange states and refusal states, which is why I'm a little puzzled by Jonathan's statement that there is absolutely no indication of contrary legislative intent. But to the extent that what he means is there are no senators and representatives making explicit statements that exchanges would be available on federally facilitated exchanges, that's because they did assume, he's right about this, that most states would happily set up their own exchanges to have more control over their exchanges and have more authority over the insurance companies that states traditionally regulate. And the reason that no senator or representative said anything suggesting that tax credits would be available on federally facilitated exchanges is because they all assumed it would be. The argument that Jonathan lays out is an argument that cuts not in his favor, but in the government's favor. The dog here didn't bark, precisely when you'd expect that it would have barked if his theory that what Congress was trying to do was use federal tax credits as leverage to get states to set up their exchanges. You'd expect some explicit hint of that to be in the legislative history somewhere, and there simply isn't. Finally, it'd be very strange to construe the ACA in a manner that would allow the states to thwart its basic purpose of achieving near universal insurance. And the question is, look, if there's an alternative construction of the statute that's available, and there is, why construe the statute in a way that would make it sort of at war with itself? And that's especially so when the alternative does a much better job making sense of the act as a whole. I'll close just by sort of, I guess, teeing up a sort of question for Jonathan. The oral arguments on March 25th did not go especially well for the federal government. And if you're a betting man, Odds are that the D.C. Circuit will vote probably 2-1 on this particular panel to invalidate the IRS rule. Who knows what will happen after that point? There's always en banc review and then eventually, potentially, Supreme Court review. But one question you might have is, well, what would happen on the ground if the Supreme Court eventually were to accept the interpretation that Jonathan is advancing? The practical upshot, of course, would be that individuals in states with federally facilitated exchanges could no longer get tax credits, which would mean that individuals who had signed up for insurance plans in the expectation that they would get tax credits would receive a rude surprise from the IRS telling them that those tax credits were no longer available because their state failed to set up an exchange. The likelihood that the ACA would just collapse as a result of this litigation, it seems pretty remote at this point. 7.5 million people have signed up for exchange plans, and many of those people have signed up through the federally facilitated exchange. So the likelihood that they would stand for letting their tax credits or their insurance be taken from them seems pretty low. The states would come under immense and immediate pressure to establish their own exchanges, and the federal government would come under some pressure to come up with a legislative fix, which it could easily do, at least in principle. In the meantime, however, there would be a ton of people out there on the street who've lost their health insurance. It would likely, again, be a transition problem as states capitulated to what I think would be immense political pressure and established their own exchanges. So I guess I, at the end of the day, find myself scratching my head about this litigation, or at least what I sense to be some real partisan appeal that the litigation has. It seems to me that if you're an employer who doesn't want to pay a penalty, I can understand why you'd bring the litigation. But I have a harder time understanding sort of why anybody should be enthusiastic about this litigation. If it goes against the government, it seems like there would be a lot of people who lose health insurance to no very good end. And I'd be curious, very curious, to get Jonathan's views on that.
Alrighty. Well, do I have a couple minutes, Dean?
Let me do this a little bit backwards. Let me open the floor to questions first, and people can begin lining up. And then, but before we go to the audience, I'll ask you for your response. So,
sure.
In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let's hear now from Jonathan Adler. Go ahead, Professor Adler.
Sure. Let me just answer Nick's question and then make just a few other very quick points. In terms of the broader question, I think this case involves a much larger principle about what the nature of agency authority is and the authority of agencies to rewrite inconvenient or ill-considered statutory text. And I think that principle is especially important when what we're talking about is authorizing money from the federal treasury that the plain language of a statute doesn't authorize. And I certainly agree with Nick that figuring out precisely how states and the federal government respond should the IRS's rule get struck down is difficult to do. And I think there's certainly a plausible case that many states will decide that it is worth subjecting their employers to penalties under the employer mandate in return for authorizing tax credits. But my view is insofar as that is what the plain language of the statute created, that particular choice, it's important to hold the federal government to that language and to give states that choice. And if that means states respond as the statute set forward, that's all to the good. I think the principle transcends the specifics of this particular case. Other points I just want to make is the language here is not broad, open-ended language that we're wondering whether or not it applies in a given case. It's very specific, explicit language. The phrase established by the state is repeated over and again in Section 36 of the Internal Revenue Code, the relevant provisions of the law. And as Judge Griffith pointed out in oral argument, there is no good explanation for what this language is doing there, if not to clarify what sort of exchanges can be used for tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies. If I were to accept, for the sake of argument, Nick's argument that a Section 1321 exchange created by the federal government is the equivalent or stands in the shoes of a Section 1311 exchange, that's fine. Let's replace Section 1311 in the statute every place it appears with Section 1311 or Section 1321. We still have a problem with the established by the state language, language that is clear, explicit, and repeated, and that is something that the government really hasn't yet to come up with an answer for. In terms of the other provisions of the law, the reporting requirements list a require that exchanges provide a lot of different types of information that is valuable to the federal government. In fact, the IRS has conceded in the last few months that this some of this information about the type of insurance that's being purchased and who's purchasing it and so on is not otherwise being collected. But the key point about these provisions as well is that they specifically identify both Section 1311 and Section 1321. And this provision, which was added in reconciliation, would, under the theory Nick outlined and that the government put forward, have generated surplusage because there was no need to reference both provisions, both Section 1311 and Section 1321, if they are the equivalents. Similarly, the qualified individual language, it's different language. It's language that clearly applies to Section 1311 exchanges, and there is language in Section 1321, which essentially instructs the federal government to create parallel restrictions for Section 1321 exchanges. So I don't think that really creates a problem either. The last two things I'll just note is the CBO, in characterizing its score, was very careful with its language. It did not say that it scored under the assumption that tax credits would be available in refusing states. It said it scored under the assumption that tax credits would be available in every state, and it did not give a basis for that assumption. What we know from the debate is that everybody assumed states would do it, and the other point that's notable about this and notable about the CBO score is the CBO never accounted for a single dollar being spent by the federal government to create federal exchanges. If the CBO had assumed there would be even one federally created exchange, it would needed to have accounted for that, those expenditures, and yet it didn't. That is further evidence that CBO, like most members of Congress, just assumed that states would, as they had in the past, accept the exchanges. And final point, the assumption here was much like the assumption about Medicaid. The assumption was simply made, even though it's not really expressed in the statute and there's no real legislative history about it, that states would accept the Medicaid expansion, that they wouldn't refuse this money that's supposed to go to the most vulnerable populations, that they wouldn't, for example, even in states that have their own exchanges, leave the poorest of the working poor, those who earn less than 100% of the poverty line, without tax credits or Medicaid, which is the result of Medicaid refusals. And yet we all know that the plain language of the statute puts a floor on tax credit eligibility and doesn't force states to take Medicaid money if they want to refuse it. So the statute is filled with provisions that apply even though they enable states to make decisions that don't result in the fulfillment of the statute's goals, and that's because that's the way Congress wrote the statute. And if that's a problem, if we don't like it, the answer is not for the IRS to rewrite the statute. The answer is for Congress to rewrite the statute.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions pending. But Professor Bagley, you want to take 60 seconds for a quick response before we go to the audience? Or
I'm happy to. Let's move to the audience questions.
Okay. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Hi. I have a question for Professor Bagley. You mentioned that legislative fix would be relatively easy, at least in principle. Why is that not a factor militating in favor of a court holding Congress to the language that it passed?
Yeah, see, you know, this argument is sort of a standard move in statutory interpretation that, look, we'll read the statute sort of in a perhaps simplistic, sort of very straightforward, almost wooden fashion, and then let Congress pick up the pieces if we get it wrong. The trouble, of course, is that at every point in our history, and not just today, in the hyper-partisan and sort of polarized environment that we're in, it's very difficult to enact legislation. And the drag, the difficulty of getting legislation enacted makes it all the more important to get right what Congress actually does enact. And so I think Jonathan would also agree with me that that our effort here is to get it right. And the question of how to get it right turns on the best interpretation of the words that Congress selected in their greater context. And you know, I don't take anybody to be contesting that principle. In some sense, what Jonathan and I are fighting about is how do we adopt an interpretation of the act that does the least violence to the text? Because, as Jonathan rightly points out, this wasn't sort of drafted under ideal circumstances. The Senate draft that became the ACA was never really meant to become the bill itself. It was supposed to go through a conference committee and get cleaned up. That didn't happen. And so at the end of the day, we have to take this human product that is itself flawed and at points self-contradictory and figure out how to make the most of it. My interpretation, the interpretation that the government is advancing, makes sense of provisions that exclude any individuals except those in states excludes anybody except those in states that have state-established exchanges from going in the exchanges. My interpretation makes sense of that provision. Jonathan's not so much. Whereas my interpretation, he's absolutely right, by the state sticks out and doesn't seem to be doing quite the work that you would normally assign to those words. And the question is, how do we make sense of the statute as a whole and get it right? Acknowledging that Congress can always come in and fix things in principle, we still have to get the statute right.
So
Professor Adler, do you want to?
Well, Nick and I disagree about what makes sense to the language. I think you can read every relevant portion of the statute entirely consistent with the plain language established by the state, especially when one accounts for the structure of the statute. What I think is conspicuous, and the federal government was unable at oral argument to explain what to do with the language established by the state. That language sticks out. The other kind of larger question, and this is one that I think academics will hopefully ponder in the future, whatever happens in this case, is here we have a statute that did not go through the normal editing and vetting process. It did not go through a House-Senate conference. It was, in many respects, a negotiating draft. This was the draft the Senate was hoping to present to the House and then negotiate over for a final bill. Because that bill was what ended up becoming the law, there's a question of how that should cut. My own view is that when Congress openly and expressly says we are going to take a statute or statutory language that we are saying is not perfect and does not do everything we want to do, and our urge to pass it, even though outside observers are saying it has lots of problems, and then they go ahead and pass it, that actually increases the reasons for sticking with the text as it's written, because the arguments that this was a mistake or a misjudgment is harder to make. There were multiple letters by experts supporting healthcare reform, many of whom have signed onto amici in this litigation, who said to the House and Senate, just get this across the finish line, we'll fix it later. That's the choice they made, and I think that's the choice that we and Congress should stick with and courts should enforce until Congress decides to do something about it.
We've got quite a few callers on the line. Before we go to our next caller, let me announce that Tuesday at 2 p.m., or Thursday at 2 p.m. rather, 1 p.m., I'm sorry, Thursday at 1 p.m., we'll be debating judicial fact-finding and sentencing. And we might add other calls this week, so check your emails and our website for additional calls. Also, because we have so many people on the call today, I want to make a special announcement about an upcoming conference the Federalist Society is hosting in conjunction with its Executive Branch Review Project. We're hosting the second annual Executive Branch Review Conference here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel on May 7th. It's a day-long conference that will include continuing legal education credits that have been applied for, featuring addresses by Congressman Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz, with panels on suspension of law, policy without process, the IRS, the HHS mandate, and on. That, again, is May 7th here in Washington and is featured on the front page of the website of the Federalist Society. So I'd urge you to take a look at that and see if you're able to attend. Today, however, we're speaking with Professors Adler and Bagley. We've got three callers pending with questions. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
I've seen a lot of discussions about these tax subsidies for the insurance plans, just assuming that is going to make the selecting of the Obamacare plan an advantage. But in a lot of cases, because the Obamacare plan is more complicated, more expensive, and more expansive than what people were previously having, it's more out of pocket. And especially because this case centers around people that are not at the top income brackets, you know, that's a major issue. So, and I'm not seeing that discussed. So I'd kind of like to see y'all's take on that.
I'm happy to, Jonathan, you're happy. I'm happy to defer to you on this.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of things. I mean, we're really focusing on the legal questions in this case. I think it's fair to say that there are a lot of things about the way insurance markets are operating and how insurance companies are responding that were not entirely anticipated by many supporters of the law. Health insurance markets are complicated things. I think that whether or not tax credits end up being available or not, there are many people who would like a range of choices that are different from what's being offered, and there are legislative proposals that have been offered that would expand the range of the sorts of plans that could be offered. One other thing I'll just note about this litigation is that one effect of the IRS rule in states that do not have their own exchanges is that by offering tax credits to individuals and thereby reducing the out-of-pocket cost for those individuals for purchasing health insurance, the IRS rule actually exposes a significant number of people to paying the individual mandate penalty that would otherwise be exempt from that penalty because insurance would be too expensive for them related to their income. And that's actually the basis upon which some of the plaintiffs in some of these cases establish standing. These are individuals that would prefer not to purchase a qualifying health insurance plan and would prefer not to pay the individual mandate penalty because of the availability of tax credits. They will be subject to the penalty where they would not have been otherwise.
Let me just follow up on that briefly. The range of plans that are offered under the ACA are now governed by several rules that people that are wildly popular with people, which include guaranteed issue, meaning that the insurance company has to write you insurance even if you've got a pre-existing condition, and what they call community rating, which is that insurance companies have to basically charge anybody who comes and asks for insurance about the same rate. Now, for very healthy people who had insurance prior to the enactment of the ACA, these provisions are not necessarily a good thing. They're going to increase the cost of insurance, because instead of being in a risk pool with only very healthy people, these individuals will be in a risk pool with a relatively unhealthier group of individuals. And the idea is that we're all in it together, and all of us can get sick at any given time. Any of us can take ill, and therefore we got to make sure that we are all sort of in an insurance pool that we've all contributed to. The tax credits are meant to offset the increase in prices that some individuals are going to see. The tax credits are keyed to income, so lower income people are going to get more benefits from that than higher income people. So if you were a very healthy person who made more than 400% of the poverty level, you would potentially see your health insurance premiums go up as a result of the enactment of the ACA. That means that there are going to be losers under the statute. The question is, how many winners do we generate? And there are actually a ton of winners out there, people who can get insurance who couldn't have gotten it before, and people who can now take advantage of tax credits to afford the insurance that would otherwise have been out of reach. Eliminating the tax credits on the federally facilitated exchanges would, as Jonathan say, mean that a lot of people weren't subject to the individual mandate. But that means, too, that a lot of people would be simply unable to purchase or to afford health insurance coverage of any kind. It would be very strange to interpret a statute that was intended quite, you know, and this was not hidden, to extend near universal coverage, not to achieve that goal in such a strange manner.
Well, let me just challenge you on that point, because, I mean, the Act clearly does that in multiple places, right? So, for example, the Act says that to be eligible for tax credits, one has to earn at least 100% of the poverty line, and one that earns less than that is not eligible for tax credits. So the poorest of the working poor are not eligible for tax credits. Now,
eligible for Medicaid.
Only if states agree expand Medicaid.
Which everyone assumed would happen prior to the Supreme Court's decision saying that the Medicaid expansion was unconstitutional and effectively giving states a choice.
Well, so, but they assumed that there was an assumption, and the assumption turned out to be wrong, and it was always conditioned upon states exercising their option, which everyone knew that they had, in a way that was consistent with those who enacted the statutes. Goals or and assumptions, but there are other provisions, the Class Act provisions, what happened with the child-only market prior or initially.
Sure, they didn't work.
A lot of the places that not only the network is infected, actually had the effect of making it harder for some people to get health insurance. And so I don't think we can say that after the fact, because of the independent choices of states or others, some of the provisions didn't have the effects that we hoped, justifies reading the language differently than it would than it plainly provides.
Well, maybe just to sort of round out the conversation on this, you know, the big hole in Jonathan's case is the absence of anybody getting up and on the floor of Congress and saying we'd like to use these federal tax credits as leverage to get the states to establish their exchanges. The reason that healthcare advocates thought that states would jump to establish their exchanges is they thought state officials would prefer to have control over their state insurance markets than to cede that control to the federal government. And given all of the anti-federal government rhetoric surrounding the ACA, that wasn't a crazy assumption. It turned out to be wrong. But if Congress did mean to use tax credits as a way to encourage states to sign up for to set up their own exchanges, you would have expected some kind of reference to that. Now you'd say, might say, sure, well, we have it in the statute established by the state. Again, it's a very roundabout way of achieving something that would have been a topic of serious conversation during the very high-profile debates over the enactment of the statute.
Just a couple of quick points on that. That we know, and several of the amici supporting the government have acknowledged, that this precise mechanism, conditioning tax benefits on state cooperation, was a feature of prior Senate bills that were being considered during the debate leading up to the Affordable Care Act. We have provisions that were enacted in the Internal Revenue Code, in fact, Section 35 of the Internal Revenue Code, that were also authored by Senator Baucus, who was the primary author of what became the ACA, that not only conditioned certain tax benefits on state cooperation with regard to health insurance, but do so structurally in almost the precise same way, that is, defining coverage month in a particular way and then creating a tie to state cooperation. So it had been done before. It had been suggested plainly in prior statutory language, and just before the decision was made to not have a conference and Scott Brown became a senator, several members of the House actually wrote a letter saying that it would be a mistake to adopt the Senate bill because the Senate bill would put too many people in states like Texas, where these members of Congress were from, at the mercy of state policymakers.
And nowhere in that letter, nowhere in that letter do they say that the federal tax credits were the reason that state officials
they don't say any reason. They don't give any reason, right? They talk in more general terms.
You would have expected them to be very specific about
that.
Well,
actually, not at all. It was a public letter. It was one that they wanted to be understandable to the press. They released it to the press. There was a press release about it. It was general language about how states could obstruct the goals of the act. And if you look at the act and you say, how could the Senate bill have enabled any state to obstruct achieving the goals of the act? Well, the Supreme Court hadn't ruled yet on NFIB, so they certainly weren't referring to Medicaid because we assumed that everyone assumed that was an opportunity good to be true. So what other provision in the law could they possibly have been referring to when they said that
states?
The
insurance rules, Texas and about five other states came out saying that they would decline to enforce any of the new insurance rules, including guaranteed issue and community rating, against any insurance companies in their states. You don't need only if HHS makes a finding, and the HHS certainly hasn't made a finding in those states, and it would be very controversial to do so. Again, if you go back and read the letter, what's startling about it is its failure to mention tax credits as leverage. Because again, if you thought that that was the meaningful risk, you'd have been screaming bloody murder about it, and you surely would have shown up in the letter.
We've got a few more callers pending. Let's go to our next call.
Hello. Really enjoying the debate, and I think this one would be for Professor Adler. It seems like there wasn't ever a time when we weren't talking about the Affordable Care Act, and frankly, I don't remember all that much debate for a bill that is 2,500 pages long. Am I, is my memory failing me, or would there have been more debate that I possibly have missed? And also, I was wondering, I had read that a lot of the bill was written, in fact, by lobbyists. And I'm wondering, how does that tie in with your comment, Professor Adler, regarding congressional intent? Do they adopt the intent of the lobbyists, or exactly how does that work?
Well, I mean, to start, I guess, go in reverse order, I think the fact that a bill, especially any bill, and especially a bill like this, is actually a child of many parents, that is to say many different pieces will have been written by many different people, is a reason why we have to focus on the text first and foremost. And that, I think, it's particularly true with a statute like this, where many members of Congress, including Senator Baucus, have made statements certainly implying that they never read the whole thing. But that when we say intent of Congress, we mean what is it that they enacted, and what does that language mean? And if language is clear and doesn't really admit of alternative interpretations, and I think established by the state, where state is capitalized, given the way states operate in our federal system, is clear language. It's the sort of language that any person with any legal training whatsoever reading would notice, oh, wow, that means established by the state. And then if they saw that state was in fact defined in the statute as one of the 50 states or districts of Columbia, they'd say, oh, Congress clearly meant state means state or D.C. They find, in addition, language that creates equivalence for territories, but no such language for the federal government. That would further underline that. And when we talk about congressional intent, we're essentially saying what is the clear meaning of the text that Congress enacts. In terms of debate, I think it is important to remember that there are many portions of this law, significant portions of this law, for which there is no meaningful legislative history the way we usually define it. There is no conference report for the bill at all. There is no real floor debate about the Medicaid provisions. In fact, there is less in the text of the Affordable Care Act and in the relevant legislative history on the Medicaid expansion and the fact that that was an inducement for states than there is about tax credits. And yet no one disputes that the plain language of the statute, when one looks at how Medicaid operates, clearly means what it clearly provides for. So I think that when we look at this statute and we wonder about the lack of detailed discussion and debate and detailed legislative history, that's a function of the way it was enacted. No one expected the Senate bill to become law. People expected the Senate bill to be a negotiating position for the Senate in a House-Senate conference. And in fact, there's reason to believe that House-Senate conference would have dispensed with the reliance upon state exchanges altogether. But of course, that was not a possibility once Senator Brown was elected and once there were no longer 60 votes in the Senate. So we didn't have a full discussion of everything that's in this particular bill because there wasn't a time really where anyone expected this particular bill to be what Congress was going to enact.
Thank you.
I just offer a little caveat on that. You know, this bill was, although it was kind of a rough draft, the Affordable Care Act was hotly debated for well over a year, and not only during the presidential campaign in 2008, but really for the entire year thereafter up to its enactment in March of 2010. So I think it's not fair to say that the bill itself didn't come in for serious debate. I think it is true that lots of individual provisions were the kinds of things that don't rise to public consciousness. And I think it's doubly true that when you're talking about an equation nestled in an obscure provision of a very lengthy and difficult to parse act, I think it's a bit of a stretch to think that the ordinary meaning of that is one that anybody on the street could plausibly discern. I think the better way of thinking about the fact that this was sort of a draft is to say, look, like any piece of legislation, this is a human document. And if you've ever tried to draft legislation, you're constantly worried about forgetting about something, about making an error, about trying to do what you can to make it as clean as humanly possible. But you know you're going to mess up. And humans mess up. And to the extent that there is kind of what appears to be something incongruous in the statute, the question that Jonathan and I are debating is what do you do with that? Do you treat it as a human document and realize that screw-ups ought to be sort of understood in the same way that a screw-up in communication can be corrected by a listener? or is it the kind of thing that we sort of woodenly insist upon for whatever good reasons that we might have, notwithstanding the effects of that interpretation and the way that it might undermine the very statute that we're setting out to interpret?
Thank you.
We've got one question pending. Let's go to our next caller. If you want to be, we probably have time for two questions, I would guess. We've got about 10 minutes left. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone.
Hi, thank you so much for the call today. I know it can be hard to forecast a decision of the court, but what might you expect the outcome of an on-bank appeal or then a Supreme Court appeal to be based on the composition of the court?
Well, let me say a couple things. First, I'm not sure what the D.C. Circuit's going to do on this panel, and then whether or not it goes en banc or Supreme Court or to the Supreme Court will depend on a variety of factors. If this D.C. Circuit were to side with the plaintiffs in this case, the federal government would have to decide whether it wants to go en banc and perhaps avoid Supreme Court review, or whether, as it did in NFIB, whether it would prefer to get more rapid review and go straight to the Supreme Court as a way of settling this issue and providing a greater certainty. And so there are a variety of factors that will go into the decision of how to proceed, depending both on what the court does and how either the federal government or the plaintiffs weigh those sorts of trade-offs. It may also be influenced by what happens in the other cases. The Fourth Circuit case will be argued next month, and so there will be a decision in that case as well relatively soon. In terms of what the court will do, I think the plain text of the statute is relatively clear, and I think that as people begin to recognize, as Nick mentioned earlier, that one possible consequence of a victory by the plaintiffs is that many states that have refused to create exchanges thus far think better of it and decide to create their own exchanges, I think that will and should make it easier for judges to simply focus on the text of the statute and worry less about the horror stories of what may or may not happen should they stick to the plain language of the statute. If one looks at the briefs in this case, one sees that many of the briefs on the government side spend page after page painting horror stories about what might happen should the plaintiffs win, and I don't really think that's the thing that courts should be focused on. And I think if courts do focus on the language, they should approach this as a fairly straightforward case. And that's a long way of not answering, not giving a real prediction.
I'll be a little bit more forthright about it. My instinct is that given that the D.C. Circuit's opinion is likely to come out well in advance of any Fourth Circuit opinion, if the decision goes against the government, and I think, judging from the oral argument, I think that's more likely than not, although I still hold out some hope. If it goes against the government, I think, is likely to take the case en banc, if for no other reason that now after filibuster reform, there are three more democratically appointed judges on the D.C. Circuit, and in an en banc vote, I think this isn't close. So far, my instinct, and I'd be curious of Jonathan's views on this, my instinct is that there are not going to be many people who swing from the left who endorse the position he advances, but I could be wrong about that. So my hunch is the D.C. Circuit would overturn the panel and do so in relatively short order. The only kind of point I'd make on that is once the D.C. Circuit acts, the likelihood that this case goes to the Supreme Court is quite a bit higher, both because other circuits will have weighed in on that point and because of the high-profile nature of the challenge and the fact that the D.C. Circuit went en banc to hear it sort of lends it a sort of air of importance. And in terms of if you're trying to predict what the Supreme Court will do, an adverse decision from the D.C. Circuit panel is probably sort of an ill omen. But we'll see. I think, as Jonathan would be the first to say, anytime you're tilting against an act of Congress, it's an uphill battle. But it definitely is a bleaker picture for the government than it was after oral argument a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, one comment on that. I've been reluctant to assume that individual judges on the D.C. Circuit in a case like this are going to be predicted purely based on who appointed them. There are
I agree with
cases,
that, by the way.
Yeah, there are numerous cases from the D.C. Circuit in which agencies did things that were largely regarded as making perfect policy sense and regarded as efforts to make clunky statutory language work better in a specific circumstance, in which judges from across the political spectrum have said, nonetheless, the statute is the statute, and that's what we're going to enforce. Plenty of examples involving the EPA, and I think this is like that. And if total maximum daily load must mean daily, even where for pollutants and in contexts in which that may produce adverse or incongruous results, it seems to me established by a state should mean established by the state, even if there are some scenarios in which that produces results that authors of the statute might not have wanted.
I worked on the case that you're referencing, Jonathan. I was working for the judge who wrote that during the term that he wrote that. And I think the distinction between that case and this case is simply that the statute here is not amenable to the same kind of interpretation on its sort of narrow text. But I take the point that you don't want to sort of assume that the judges are simply going to vote on a party line fashion. I don't think that's likely to happen.
Let's take a final question.
Professor Bagley, I was just curious. The Obama administration had raised issues regarding jurisdictional questions, including whether the plaintiffs had standing and whether the suit was barred by the Anti-Injunction Act. And mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
So I'm going to leave the AIA to tax experts. I've always thought the standing argument here that the government made was pretty weak. It seems to me that an employer that is subject to the mandate penalty by dint of one of its employees going on an exchange and getting tax credits, if the employer can come in and say, I would not be subject to this tax penalty if none of my employees got tax credits, that seems to be enough to get standing. The employer is probably not going to win an employer of the month award saying, I want none of my employees to get insurance and I don't want to give it to them either. But I think they certainly have standing. And I'm frankly just not persuaded by that portion of the government's brief.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think on the Anti-Injunction Act arguments, I think that courts have been reluctant to approach that much differently here than the Supreme Court did in FIB, even though it does involve a different provision of the act. And so courts have not been particularly, efforts by the federal government to dismiss a bunch of these cases have been rebuffed on those grounds. The last point I'd just make, which hasn't been brought up, is if the D.C. Circuit were to side with the plaintiffs, one thing that will be worth watching is what the remedy is that the D.C. Circuit then provides. I'm not convinced that were the D.C. Circuit to invalidate the rule that would necessarily require clawing back any subsidies that have been issued or guaranteed, that there would at least certainly be arguments that any effect of the rule, for example, the rule being struck down might not be effective until the next tax year or something like that. And that will certainly be something to pay attention to when the D.C. Circuit gives its final decision.
Well, let me thank both Professors Jonathan Adler and Nicholas Bagley. We certainly appreciate your remarks today, a nice contrast of views. A reminder to our audience to check out the Federal Society's website and look into the second annual Executive Branch Review Conference. Also, our next scheduled telephone conference call Thursday at 1 p.m. when we'll be looking at sentencing and judicial fact-finding. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.